Hello and welcome to Literary Loitering. We are the Geek Show show dedicated to all things books and arts related.
Yeah, but we don't want to do books and arts today because it's free comic book day.
Yes, it is. We have literally a mountain of comic books to read.
Yes, we could literally bury ourselves in comic books today because of free comic book day. And so we're reluctantly doing the show.
Yeah, I guess we'll talk about books with words and no pictures.
But the news delivered.
Yes, it did.
The news has actually delivered.
It came to save us in our dark day.
Yes. So anyway, I am Rob.
And I'm Andrew.
So let's get right into
it. Well, just before we start,
should
probably say that if you like our shows, you can go support our GoFundMe page or just share it around with, you know, whoever might be interested.
Yeah, it's on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk.
Yep, where you can also find The Geek Shop, where we have lots of lovely items for sale. And you can listen to some of our old shows, which you can also find on Mixcloud and on YouTube. We're coming soon to Stitcher. We're very close to being on iTunes.
Yes, we are.
And yeah, we're just slowly spreading all over the internet.
Yes.
Like geeky Marmite.
I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, I do. It's with a let's get on with the show.
Yes. Anyway, so what have we got in the news this week?
Well, first of all, we have very exciting news that a lost work of Walt Whitman's has finally been found.
Really?
Yep.
And this is Walt Whitman,
the poet.
Yeah, the war poet.
Yeah. The one what was on Breaking Bad once.
Okay. So, is this another war poem that they found?
It's... no.
Okay, judging by the look on your face, if you could see the look on his face, he's like Crichton when Crichton enters smug mode.
This is Walt Whitman's Manly Health and Training, a 47,000-word treatise on how to be a real man.
Treatise?
Oh, treatise.
Treatise.
Treatise. Treatises.
I was going to say, a treatise, isn't that like a sweet?
Yes. That's a 47,000-word tootsie roll.
Yes. Oh, before we get into this, you know I look for bargains all over the place.
Yes.
Right. I have seen the single most, I don't know how to describe it, but looking, even just holding this tub in my hands made me feel like I was going to get diabetes. I've never seen so much sugar in something, and it had like glucose and sucrose and fructose. And you know the Stay Puft marshmallows?
Yeah.
Right? There's some places where you can get Stay Puft marshmallows imported from America, so they're full of sugar. This was a Stay Puft marshmallow spread.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, God, I can feel my heart constricting just thinking about it.
So you can imagine how I'm feeling when I'm holding this tub. Sorry, it was just you saying Tootsie Roll reminded me of that, so I thought I'd share that with everybody. Anyway.
Yes. But anyway, so after you've eaten, like, the entire jar of Stay Puft marshmallow spread, you can then follow Walt Whitman's advice to get a noble physique.
What exactly is a noble physique?
Well, apparently it's the kind of body you get from a simple meat diet, no sweets, fried food or even vegetables, a brisk leap out of bed in the mornings, and not exhausting oneself continually among women.
You mean like shopping, putting up shelves, mowing the lawn, that sort of thing?
Yes, Rob.
So, yeah, okay, we understand what you're saying. I have a couple of issues with this particular regime. You know, not exhausting yourself with women. Okay, fine. But the brisk leap out of bed in the morning, you know, is that the only exercise you're getting during the day?
It's the only exercise you need.
A brisk leap out of bed every morning.
Yeah. See, I'm just imagining some sort of like Wallace and Gromit type device.
I know.
It's like flinging you out of bed.
Oh, your bed is suddenly a catapult.
Yes.
Oh, a trebu bed. Or trebedcher.
Trebedcher.
Yeah. Just flinging you out of bed in the morning. If you don't press the snooze button quick enough. Oh, right. Anyway. So,
what time is Johnson going to be in this morning? And just crashes through the roof.
No, well, not that. He's just against the window like some pigeon. Right, so Walt Whitman had this idea.
Yeah, Walt Whitman, the original bro.
Yeah, I know. Do you know when you said the noble physique?
Yes.
You know what I was imagining? Remember those old adverts that used to be in comic books where you had the guy and he had like the leopard print Speedos on?
Yes, that you too could look like this.
Exactly. That's what I was imagining, complete with like handlebar mustache.
From now on, I'm going to imagine that is how Walt Whitman dressed.
And just the whole idea of you could be on the beach and no one's going to kick sand in your face. Last time I went to the seaside, nobody kicked any sand in my face.
Well, no. Because no one would dare, because they might kick a needle by accident.
Yeah, I know. No, this was a nice sandy beach. This was a well-kept beach, well-maintained. And still no one kicks sand in my face.
Those exist.
Yes, those exist. In other countries.
Yeah.
And nobody,
not here.
Nobody kicks sand in my face because I'm kind of a bear, even though I'm like 40 and 40 and overweight. I still look like a bear. So.
Yeah. Yes, Rob, you are a bear.
No, I'm not bear.
I mean, I assume everyone was kind of just running away, fleeing in terror. That's why they couldn't kick sand in your face.
Yes. Everyone's going, shark! And then out on the beach is going, bear! Bear versus shark. Fight of the century. That could actually work as well. If you think about it, bear versus shark.
I don't know, because surely it depends on what terrain they're fighting on.
Well, the thing is, because the bears can go into the water, can't they, to catch fish? And
yeah.
The sharks can come into the shallows to catch humans.
Okay, yeah, I guess if, like, the bear is on land and the shark is in the shallows.
Yeah, well, if they're both in the shallows, bear versus shark can be a thing.
It can.
We could have the fight of the century. Who would win, though? I mean, if you had, like, a black bear or a grizzly or even a polar bear.
I'd say shark over, like, black or grizzly, but polar bear over shark.
Yeah, because polar bear is, like, pound for pound the strongest animal in the world, isn't it?
Yes, but you see, Rob, you're thinking too small scale, because the real winner is us.
Yes.
After they've both killed each other, we take their DNA, and we make the bear shark.
Oh, no. But I do think it should have the ring announcer for that fight should be Ken Watanabe.
Yes.
Always Ken Watanabe. Just
let them fight.
Yes. Just walks on. Let them fight. Paycheck.
Just got, I love that his entire character arc in that movie is convincing everyone that they don't need to do anything.
Yeah. And the thing is, they don't.
No.
Nobody actually needs to do anything.
Because Godzilla's got this.
And exactly. And it's only Ken Watanabe who actually understands this. And that's the sad thing about that entire movie. All that people need to do was evacuate the cities, get everybody out of the area so there's no collateral damage, and let Godzilla do his thing. That's all you need to do.
That's why Ken Watanabe should be president of the world.
Yes. And Obama, if you're listening, seriously, become British and just, you know, take over here. We'll have you since America doesn't want you.
We're the country you deserve, Obama.
Yes. And he's the prime minister that we deserve.
Yes.
Did you see the results for the mayoral election in London?
Heard that Sadiq Khan is now the mayor of London.
Yeah, the first Asian Muslim mayor of a major Western city.
That is pretty cool.
Do you know how he won, though?
Is it by his incredible ability to not be Boris Johnson?
Partly because of that, but also because the Conservatives basically imploded a little bit during the campaign.
I'm not that surprised.
Well, the Conservative candidate tried to accuse Sadiq Khan of hanging out with terrorists.
Oh, my God. No, not cool, Conservatives. Not cool.
No, it's, you know, he fraternizes with terrorists, apparently. I'm like, this is what? When did we become America? So, yeah.
Surely that's only good. I mean, Sadiq Khan can defend London with his Muslimic death rays.
I don't know. Anyway, we were on Walt Whitman. We've kind of got sidetracked a little bit. We've meandered into politics.
We have. Where are we, Rob? I'm scared and confused.
I don't know. We went from, like, from comic book adverts to the mayor of London. I don't know how we managed to get to that point, but back to Walt Whitman, safer shores.
Indeed. So, yeah, that's most of the story. I think I've got kind of like, yes, the full sort of extract from the book. America has mentality enough, but needs a far nobler physique. And there is no doubt, as things now are, among the young men of modern civilized life, in cities, that a healthy manly virility seems to be almost lost. Seems to have given way to a morbid, almost insane pursuit of women, especially of the lowest ranges of them, from the mere reputation of the sensual pleasure. A man that exhausts himself continually among women is not fit to be, and cannot be, the father of sound and manly children. Even the daughters.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
They will be puny and scruffless, a torment to themselves and those who have the charge of them. So yeah, watch out, America.
Thing is, Walt Whitman actually was quite prescient with his words. Because if you look at America now, how many Americans have a noble physique?
And how many of them are puny and scruffless?
Well, puny is it's one of those words that is difficult to use when you're describing the majority of Americans who, you know, I know now why they build monster trucks.
You mean the overcompensators?
Yes, but it's not because of overcompensation. It was originally. Now it's just basically because normal suspension can't handle the load.
This is just a normal-sized car for them now.
Exactly. Do you know what it is? They've probably looked at monster trucks like Bigfoot and that and went, you know, we seem tiny in this car. We need to get bigger.
Yes, only in America would you like look at a giant car and go, well, I guess I'll have to make myself bigger.
Yes. Maybe they took the, you remember the advice, if you meet a bear, maybe they took that a bit too seriously.
Make themselves big so they'll be more intimidating.
We're back to bears again.
Is this what happened, Rob? Did you visit America and now everyone's got themselves fat?
I think so. Just me wandering around. You need to be big in case you run into a bear. Really? Okay, I shall supersize then.
God, like, McDonald's did you use that as a slogan, like, supersized for your own safety.
Moving on.
Yes, I think we should definitely move on. Bob, have you got something for us?
Yes, I do. And we're moving into the realms of Tintin.
Yeah, great, right. Tintin.
Now, two pages of Hergé's adventure story, King Ottokar's scepter, have been auctioned in Paris and achieved a higher price than expected, a much higher price than they expected. The original artwork for the last two pages of the Tintin comic sold for a total of 1.046 million euros,
or
0.82 million pounds, or 820,000 pounds.
For two pages?
Yes. This is only the second time a Tintin plate has exceeded €1 million, said Eric Leroy. He's a comic book expert at the French auction house Art Curiel. And the double page plate, which was also from King Ottokar's scepter, was sold for €1.5 million at Sotheby's in Paris in October last year. So Tintin seems to be the in thing at the moment when it comes to collections. If you can get a plate, an original plate for Tintin, you're sitting on a small fortune, or a large fortune, depending on which Tintin it is. If it's one of the early ones, like Tintin in the Congo, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you imagine an original plate from Tintin in the Congo going on sale with all the controversy surrounding it?
Ooh, you'd be in the money.
Yes, you'll be well in the money because people will buy it. Anyway.
Fine. Actually, I own a copy of Tintin in the Congo.
Cool.
So it's fine. Just like rip the two pages of that out. Make my millions.
Yep. Anyway, Art Curiel originally estimated that Saturday's lot would fetch between 600 and 800,000 euros before fees. So getting over €1 million is an excellent result for the auction house since they take, what was it, 10%?
Yeah, that is. Like, someone's eyes will have just turned to dollar signs.
Seriously. Running an auction house is a license to print money.
Pretty much.
because you don't actually need to do anything except sell it on behalf of other people. And you get 10% of that.
Yeah, yeah, literally, someone rocks up with a thing like, yeah, I want to sell this. And they're basically, they're fancy pawnbrokers, aren't they?
Yes. And we mean pawnbrokers as in, you know, resellers of items, not pawnbrokers as in...
Well, depends what's going on auction, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does.
I think we might be in the wrong business, Rob.
Yeah. Anyway, King Ottokar's Scepter was originally published in 1939, and it's the 8th installment of the adventures of Tintin. And it was originally intended by Hergé as a criticism of Nazi Germany, and the story sees Tintin help thwart a plot to overthrow the king of a fictional Central European country, which is threatened by an aggressive neighbour.
Yeah, that seems like a not-so-subtle criticism.
Yep. So, yeah, it's a lot of money.
That is indeed a lot of money.
Anyway, over to you.
Yes, we've got a story that the Russian Culture Ministry has denied reports of book burning.
Yes, I heard about this. Now, book burning is one of those things where, when you get right down to it, only crazy people burn books, because books can't hurt you, unless you're afraid of ideas.
Yeah, like, I can't even understand the mentality that, like, because this book is dangerous, it must be destroyed.
I mean, okay, I would never burn a book, but if it was a copy of Fifty Shades of Grey, not Fifty Shades of Grey, Twilight, you know, and it had nice, soft, thin pages and I was out of toilet paper, I could find a secondary use for it. You know, it's kind of recycling.
Yeah, well, in the same way I could understand if you were impoverished and this book is the only thing you've got and you need fuel.
Yeah, and you understand why I didn't say Fifty Shades of Grey for my example.
Because then it would be 50 shades darker.
Yes, it would. Anyway, so there are ways to recycle books. I mean, there was a great idea came out from Japan, and I didn't even realize this. What the guy did, right, he took some manga, but this works for any book, took it, and he put it in this Perspex pot that's designed specifically to fit, you know, a volume of manga, but you could do it for any book. And it would work really well with 50 Shades, Twilight, stuff like that. And what he did, he basically put some seeds inside, in between the pages, and just added water. And the seeds started growing up out of the books. And they actually grew really well as well. Because it's just paper. Paper's made from wood. It contains all the nutrients that a growing plant needs.
Yeah, so it's basically the same as planting it in soil, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a neat idea.
It's very clever, isn't it?
I like it.
You know, so there are ways to recycle books. You don't need to burn them. And if it's a book that's rare or hard to get hold of, then even more so, don't burn it. Give it to me.
we'll find a use for it.
Yeah.
But anyway, apparently this is all kind of spinning out from a report in January.
Yeah.
That Russian authorities had... were reported to have burned 53 books and removed more than 500 other volumes from two university libraries in northwestern Komi Republic on the grounds that they contained sentiments alien to Russian ideology. But basically a spokesperson from that authority has said that the reports have been misinterpreted by the media. So, yeah, apparently the books have been withdrawn from circulation and stored in a warehouse.
Okay. I am curious about this Russian ideology thing. What exactly is Russian ideology?
That Putin is great, Putin is fab. He's the best leader that we've ever had.
Isn't that the same thing as North Korean ideology?
Shh, no, Rob. Because North Korea probably doesn't have agents listening to the show.
All I know is that in China and in Russia and in North Korea, the words party political broadcast mean something very different.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say to this.
Yeah, no, I feel like the problem is if it was like France or somewhere where like the reports of book burning and like the Ministry of Culture was all, no, it's all a huge misunderstanding. Like it would be easy to shake off, but it's just as Russia, isn't it?
Yeah. And we know that Russia, we know that Putin in particular is quite strict about any criticism aimed at him or his government. That punk, or so-called punk band, was it Pussy Riot?
Yeah, Pussy Riot.
And I love the name because BBC had to say it on the news repeatedly.
It was great watching, like, very uncomfortable middle-class men and women in suits having to try and say that name.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, and we're allowed to say it because it's the name of the band. It's like the Bastard Trench all over again.
It is.
So, yeah. Anyway, they basically put them in prison for a bit, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why the whole the books have been taken out of circulation comment caught my eye.
Yeah.
It definitely seems like something is up.
Yeah. We shall watch this space if any more news comes out.
Indeed we shall.
Anyway, shall we move on? Because we've got two more pieces of news.
Yes, we shall move on.
To science.
Yay, science.
From Russia to science. Now, scientists writing in the Journal of Interdisciplinary Science Topics have argued that the miniature characters in Mary Norton's classic children's novel, The Borrowers, could not exist because if they did, they would be virtually blind, deaf, and perilously cold.
Thanks for that, science. Glad to see you're not wasting your time.
On something that is completely made up.
Has no one explained to scientists, like, the concept of fiction?
I don't know.
Because I feel like this is the kind of thing they do all the time.
I mean, it's like, I mean, Lord of the Rings, let's take Lord of the Rings as an example. Oh, yeah, let's see. Could the Eye of Sauron actually exist? Let's prove it by science. Scientists don't believe in magic, do they? No. Then how are you going to prove it?
Could be Clark's third law, couldn't it?
But if it was Clark's third law, surely Sauron wouldn't be using a sword. He'd have, like, a howitzer instead.
Well, or it could be that Lord of the Rings actually takes place in a world where, like, some ancient civilization has visited them, and there's still leftover technology hanging around that people use for science. What if the Eye of Sauron is actually just a gigantic hologram projector?
Could be. It's possible. I'll agree with you on that.
Or also, what if it's a fantasy series and just magic is magic?
Exactly.
And it doesn't need to be explained.
Exactly. Because magic is magic, as you said.
I mean, I do still find, like, fairly interesting when sometimes people will, like, look at something and kind of do some science on it.
Yeah. I mean,
I feel like there's a limit. It's like, yes, we know the tiny people in The Borrowers aren't, like, realistically feasible.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't be very, very British for a start.
No, they wouldn't.
I'm sure they have their own concept of right and wrong, and the clothes they wear, you know, are very much in keeping with the fashion of big people, or big jobs, as the Knack McFeagle call them. I don't understand this research. This is one of those things that somebody got a research grant for.
Yeah, it's a weird waste of time.
I know.
Like, we have diseases that need curing.
I know what we need to do.
What do we need to do?
We need to put forward a research grant proving that the Discworld couldn't possibly exist.
Yes, like, after years of laborious scientific research, we will prove that turtles can in fact not breathe in space.
Yes.
Yes, I'd be up for it.
And we need £150,000 to prove this.
Yes, well, we need to get plenty of research material.
Yes, turtles.
Turtles and catapults.
Turtles and catapults. Why the catapults? Well, we can't afford rockets to fire them into space.
See, that's good, because we're being cost-effective as well.
Yes, we are. Good work! there's our new Kickstarter campaign.
Honestly, the sad thing is, if, like, we went on Kickstarter and put, we need this amount of money to build a catapult to shoot turtles into space,
we'll probably get
it. Yeah, we would.
We'll probably get the money as well. In fact, I have this mental image that you have people like Branson and Bill Gates and Elon Musk just sitting there watching Kickstarter waiting for these big ideas.
Oh, no. We should copyright the turtle catapult.
Yes. No, it's already ours. It's already ours now. And just the only thing we've got to be careful of is the creator of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
You're right. They could sue.
Thing is, they didn't make a turtle catapult as far as I remember. So it is our original idea. And then you've got James Dyson just off to one side and he's like, I can make that better.
So eventually we'll have the cordless turtle pack catapult.
No, no, no. It'll have one of those little, tiny little digital motors that spins at like five times the speed of a race car engine, an F1 engine. It'll just, you know, our catapult, our original design, the prototype, might just fling it a few hundred meters, but Dyson's one will probably shoot it into space. Because that's what he does. Have you seen his new hairdryer? Yeah. It's ridiculously powerful and quiet.
But we want to be old James Dyson, things don't need to be this powerful. But other parts of me do love the idea of how, like, going, oh, look at this lawnmower. We should stick a car engine on it.
Yep. Well, Dyson's one of those who would probably look at the lawnmower and go, I can make this better. And then, like, 3 weeks later, there's the new Dyson lawnmower, which doesn't just cut your grass. It compacts it into tiny, tiny cubes at the same time. So you can see.
You're giving him ideas, Rob.
You know, no, it turns it into compost after it's done, automatically just compresses it and turns it into this, like, really condensed compost, which looks like Oxo cubes. Then you just sprinkle them onto the soil where you want to grow stuff.
Just the opportunity for pranks. What's that? The gravy's a bit lumpy this week.
Why am I eating? Why does this gravy taste like dandelions? Anyway, back to the borrowers. So, yeah, scientists, please start differentiating between fiction and real world stuff. There's real world research that needs doing.
Yeah, I mean, like, I get it how sometimes someone will want to spend, like, maybe an hour or so disproving, like, something within a fictional universe that's meant to be portrayed realistically, but obviously isn't.
Yeah.
Like, say, Batman outrunning a nuclear blast somehow.
This is the best bit about this article. Just going to read from it. But the new study shatters the scientific possibility of Norton's Charming World, pointing out that biology and physics do not necessarily scale down uniformly to suit smaller beings. To begin with, at roughly 16 times smaller than a normal human, Arete Clock, the main character, would have 16 times as much surface area relative to her mass, meaning that she would lose heat much faster than normal-sized human beings. Smaller mammals correct for this by having faster metabolism relative to body size. But at the same metabolic rate as humans, Arete would have to wear extremely thick coats to maintain a healthy body temperature.
Again, this is the other problem I have. Maybe they don't have the same metabolic rate as humans. Problem solved.
Yeah. Her hearing would also be powerless, meaning that she would barely be able to detect where hostile humans were coming from in order to run away from them because she doesn't have giant ears like a mouse. The study's authors show how the reduced distance between Arete's left and right ear would confuse her interaural time difference mechanism, the means by which her brain makes sense of sound waves reaching the different ears at slightly different times.
Who does this help?
Nobody. And why go into so much detail?
Unless this is all part of some secret government experiment to actually make Ant-Man a real superhero.
Oh, no, there's a possibility.
Like, that's the only logical way I can think of why this study exists.
See, the thing is, this study also kind of disproves Ant-Man at the same time.
Jesus, special helmet.
Well, no, he has the special helmet and the outfit and everything like that. So, it means that Ant-Man's outfit would have to basically have the same heat retention as layers of thick clothing in the Arctic. And his helmet would have to sort out the audio-visual stuff.
Yeah, but pim particles.
Pim particles. Or pimp particles. Ant-Man with bling.
Which, actually, going back to, like, the good times when it's okay to do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because, come on, Ant-Man. You say in the film that his powers work by shrinking the space between atoms. And then he shrinks smaller than an atom.
Well, would you like to know?
That's not even science. That's just basic logic problems.
Would you like to know some of the other things that have been settled by science that are just at the end of this article?
Oh, we've got like a whole list of things.
There's like four more that are settled by science, right? Pinocchio. he would have broken his neck after telling just 13 lies.
That's kind of depressing.
Yep. Miley Cyrus, she could not come in just like a wrecking ball without serious injury.
That one I approve of.
I mean, I've got the Miley Cyrus article open in front of me, and they literally, they've got equations on there to show that she'd be a wreck if she came in like a wrecking ball. And there's some other great published papers for this. What else? Star Wars. Princess Leia is nearly 2 years older than twin Luke Skywalker.
Oh, because of weird space physics.
Yep. Spider-Man would need 43-inch hands to stick to a wall.
Oh, you know what they say about a guy with big hands.
Yep. Does Winnie the Pooh have a B12 deficiency? The viability of throwing giant tortoises into mines. Oh, I'm gonna have to look through this. Some of these are just amazing.
I know, we laugh, but seriously, they shouldn't be spending money on this kind of stuff.
It's from the University of Leicester as well.
Are these all from the University of Leicester?
Oh, yeah. Hang on. The great one. How long would it actually take to catch them all? That's a great question. Does Archer's drinking fit within the NHS guidelines?
No, it doesn't. I don't think that one needs a study. That's pretty easy to answer.
Would Mad Max make a good blood bag? The effects of living underground for 15 years on the health of Kimmy Schmidt.
Nice.
Does Mallory Archer's drinking fit within the drinking guidelines for an elderly lady?
Again, no. No, it doesn't.
Calculating the minimum amount of income Genovia makes from exporting pears. Energy expenditure of Monster University's slug monster. Effects of dumping pig manure into a lake. The Simpsons movie.
Right.
Where are we? Nobody tosses a dwarf, modelling Gimli being tossed by Aragorn. there's all of them. Where are we? There's got to be one good one to finish. This is the Journal of Interdisciplinary Science Topics. The toxic components of chili con carne. Oh, yeah. How much has Maggie cost Marge by going through the checkout so far? Yep. And, are the home trees in James Cameron's Avatar structurally possible?
Well, clearly not, since they got burned down.
Yep. This is volume 5 from 2016. I think I'm going to have to look through some of these because this sound amazing. Anyway, we're going to leave the journal there.
Yes, because we have one last story.
Which is kind of science-y.
Yes. Graham Whiting, a private school head teacher, has urged pupils not to read Game of Thrones books, claiming they can damage their sensitive subconscious brains. Okay, so he wrote, I want children to read literature that is conducive to their age and leave those mystical and frightening texts for when they can discern reality and when they have first learned to love beauty.
Sorry, what?
Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, The Hunger Games and Terry Pratchett, to mention only a few of the modern world's must-haves, contain deeply insensitive and addictive material, which I am certain encourages difficult behaviour in young children. Yet, they can be bought without a special license and can damage the sensitive subconscious brains of young children, many of whom may be added to the current statistics of mentally ill young children. He wrote words.
I don't know how to respond to this. And he's saying these kids are mentally ill, but I'm sorry, your argument sounds like you're mentally ill.
Yeah. Well, like... He's basically saying, like, kids should stick to the classics instead.
What?
Like classics? Shakespeare.
Really?
Yes, because Shakespeare doesn't contain any dark or violent imagery.
Really? What's her name? Was it Ophelia? What happens to her? I wonder, has he read Macbeth at all?
Apparently not.
What about Hamlet? I'm sorry. Midsummer Night's Dream. Nobody was on the opium on that one, were they?
No. See, even the article that, like, reading this off on the Telegraph, because he also mentions, oh, they should read, like, poems by Keats. And then the server says, so, yeah, ironically, one of Keats's most famous poems, Lamia, is about a seductive serpent woman.
He actually says that?
Yeah. Like, in the article, because clearly even the Telegraph thinks this is ridiculous.
He's the kind of person who would give me a headache just talking to him. Or her. Is it him or her?
It's a him. Oh, his name is Graham.
Oh, God, yeah. He's the kind of person that would give me a headache just talking to him.
Because he's so dumb. So painfully dumb.
And he's a teacher?
Yeah, he's a head teacher.
Really?
Yep, I will just find the school what he is the head teacher of.
Please, because I want to write to the school governors and say, your head teacher sucks.
Yep, he founded the Acorn School.
The Acorn School.
Where children do not wear the uniforms or take state exams.
Are they? Do they have wilderness rangers?
Probably.
Squeak, squeaking, squeak. Did you take my acorn? Oh, I found the article that you're talking about, and there's one bit, one line that stands out for me. Just, he ends by telling parents, it is the duty of parents to spend time to study such matters and form their own conclusions. Most parents already have. Not to think that because the world is filled with such sensational literature, they have to have it for their children because everybody else does. That's usually not how it works, because they're books, not video games. Beware the devil in the text. Choose beauty for your young children.
What is he on?
I don't know.
And I thought initially, like, the main problem I was going to have with it. In fact, no, it still is a big problem. Game of Thrones isn't a children's book.
No, neither actually is Lord of the Rings.
I mean, like, it is at least more suitable for children than Game of Thrones is.
When was the last time you saw a kid reading Lord of the Rings?
I'd say, like,
The Hobbit, I
can
understand.
Yeah, not like young kids.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my point. You look at it, and he's talking about kids, and obviously by his arguments, he's talking about young kids.
Well, yeah, that is kids young enough to not be able to distinguish fantasy from reality.
Yeah.
Okay, kids who probably can't read yet.
Or can't read good. You know, can't read words good and stuff.
No, do not know how make the good talky talk.
Now, what was that Zoolander one? Kids who can't read.
The Dark Zoolander Academy for kids who can't read or write good.
Yeah. Apparently some parent and former teacher agreed with his views, saying, I absolutely agree with Graham Whiting's views. For me, having read the first book of Harry Potter and watched one of the movies, I feel that the darkness of the books is so palpable that it wasn't the sort of thing that we would want to expose young children to in their formative years. You're not supposed to.
No. That's why it's got, like, ratings on it.
Yes. I think there's an element that's so detailed about occultism that it can desensitize children to the dark things in the world at a time when we want to build them up in a positive way. Which is ironic since she's only read the first Harry Potter book.
Yeah, it's... Oh my God. We somehow, like, slipped back in time to when it's all, oh no, fantasy books will lead to Satan worship.
Yes.
But we're back there again, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And it's all started off with a tiny, tiny acorn.
So my favourite thing is still, like, the idea that people need a special license to buy fantasy books.
I only have one question, and I can guarantee that the answer is no. Have either Mrs. Ellis or Mr. Whiting ever even bothered looking at the current in thing with teenagers and kids? The current big thing with teenagers and kids are video games and anime. Those are the two big things, aren't they?
Oh, well, don't even point them towards those, Rob.
Just saying. Just throwing it out there.
Although still, I would love to, like, just sit them down in front of, like, One Punch Man and say, yeah, this is what all the kids are into nowadays. And yep. Just watch kind of, like, the blood slowly trickle out their nose.
Oh, no. Even better than that would be to find out that they bought Call of Duty for their own underage kids.
So they probably did.
Yeah. Because most parents have.
Yeah. And then they go and complain about, oh, violent video games are ruining our children.
Oh, no. Violent stories. Why not fantasy stories? They're destroying our children's minds. Why are we exposing our children to this? Little 8-year-old Timmy wants The Witcher 3. Yeah, I've got no problem with that.
Oh, no. For these people, it's clearly Little Tarquin.
Yes. Who's got his shorts on backwards? Yes. I remember the old Boddington's advert. Melanie Sykes. I used to love Melanie Sykes.
Anyway, that's enough news now, I think.
Now you got me thinking about Melanie Sykes.
We'll take a break while Rob thinks of Melanie Sykes.
Well, she was great on the Boddington's adverts. And she also hosted that chat show with Terry Wogan.
Hello, and I'm Lewis from Keyframe, the geek show's coolest and most composed anime podcast. Just like an anime protagonist. No, we're crazy as heck, but watch us anyway. You'll like it. Trust me. That first bit was a lie.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Literary Loitering. And today, we are going to be having some Roman time.
Yes, fancy-dancy Roman times.
So what have you got then, Andy?
So I have got Clash of Eagles by Alan Small, which is published by Titan Books and is part one in the Hesperian Trilogy.
Ooh.
So this is a series of alternate history fiction.
Yeah.
So the idea is the Roman Empire never fell, and now in the 1200s, they basically discovered America. The prologue to this story is that they found a Viking longship because they've also kind of taken over the Vikings as well, so have them work for them.
Yeah.
So they found a Viking pirate longship filled with gold, but they killed all the Vikings inside, and so now they're desperately trying to find out where did they get all this gold from, and in looking for that, discovered this new continent. And so the story starts with Gaius Marcellinus, who is our protagonist, leading the 33rd Legion in basically a massive march across America trying to find gold.
Okay.
And kind of during their march, they come across two different tribes of Native Americans, the Arauca and the Cahokians. And basically the Arauca, they kind of hide in the bushes, snipe at them with arrows, kind of kill a couple of their men, but they kind of discard them as just, you know, base savages.
Yeah.
After all, you know, they're the Roman Legion. They have, like, steel armor and swords. They can kill them in a fair fight. So eventually they come to Cahokia, which is the Cahokian huge city that they've built.
Yeah.
And figure, you know, by this point it's midwinter. They're low on supplies. They're going to storm in there, going to take their corn, feed their army. Only then something comes out of the Cahokian city. It's basically a plane.
What?
Because this is set in the idea that the Native Americans have invented, like, rudimentary gliders.
Wow.
Yeah. So, basically, they come out in this huge thing they call a Thunderbird.
Yeah.
And because another thing they've invented by themselves is an equivalent to Greek fire.
Wow.
Yeah, and they basically just drop that on the Roman Legion, wipe them out to a man, except for Gaius, who is then basically captured by the Cahokians and taken in so they can learn, you know, who these Romans are, why they're invading. But basically, as he's being held captive, he kind of comes to more sort of associate with the Native Americans, realizes they're not savages, they've got their own culture. And I like that he's got this whole Roman thing of they beat us in a fair fight, so I can't hold that against them.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and so eventually he becomes more and more a part of their society and starts trying to build all the advanced things that Roman civilization has. Because his overall plan is he knows eventually the Romans are going to come back. Either someone survived, managed to send off word back to Rome of what's happened, or no one survived, and eventually the Romans are going to send someone, you know, to find out what's happened.
Yeah.
So Gaius thinks, if he can build up Cahokia to basically show they've accepted some of Roman civilization, then maybe he can broker a peace between the two peoples.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, this is a bloody good book.
Bloody good book.
Yeah, bloody good.
Really?
Like, I think I really got into it, basically, around the massive battle between the Colchians and the Romans. Because it's just, it's done in this rich descriptive style. It's very reminiscent of Bernard Cornwell.
Ooh.
Like, to the point that I was reading parts of this book, like, almost forgetting this isn't real historical fiction. Like, that none of this actually happened.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Yeah.
And I think what I really like, though, is this doesn't make the mistake that 99% of fantasy does, which is taking itself too seriously.
Yeah.
Like, there's this bit, because basically when Gaius arrives in Cahokia, he doesn't speak any of their language, they don't speak any of his. So they basically send three children to learn language from him. Because these children, they're really good at learning language. And they sort of end up becoming his friends, and they have this amazing relationship. Because at one point, the main thing the Colchians want Gaius for is to teach them kind of how to fight like Romans.
Yeah.
Because they can see the advantage in having like these organized battle tactics that they have. But when they first want him to teach him, he's just helped them fend off an Iroquois invasion, and he's quite badly injured. So that, like, he can barely stand and swing a sword. And one of the children basically, like, goes up and starts admonishing these, like, massive Cahokian warriors. Because there is nothing scarier than an 8-year-old girl who has an important job to do.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah. I mean, like, meanwhile, all the village women start, like, tending to him. And there's even this old grandma lady who just kind of stands there feeding him gruel and tutting at him.
Oh, this sounds amazing.
It is so good.
Oh, I think I'm going to have to settle down with this.
Yeah, it is, because another thing that a lot of fantasy novels do, especially now, is this kind of this prevailing need for everything to be like, oh, it's this huge 500-page sweeping epic.
Yeah.
And this, it's 375 pages long.
Manageable, then.
Yeah. But it means everything's tightened down.
Yeah.
So you still get this, like, nice gradual progression as he kind of becomes more and more part of society. So that's learning more and more of their language. Which, that's another thing. It's really amazing how, like, he managed to put all this emotion in these conversations basically taking place in broken English. Like, a lot of the original conversation is just like, Gaius, walk river.
Yeah.
Like, say, no, Gaius, not walk river. But, like, they still have these, like, deep, meaningful conversations, even though it's, like, in this weird broken pidgin.
That's really good.
Yeah. But anyway, but because of the length, it means everything's still nice and tight. Like, there's no bits where it feels like it's dragging its heels or ambling off in some weird direction.
It keeps the pace flowing really well.
Yeah, yeah.
Or keeps the narrative flowing really well, keeps the pace quite, you know.
Yeah, because I guess, yeah, that's a better way of putting it, because it's not especially fast-paced.
Yeah.
Because the book takes place over the course of about 2 years.
Yeah, but it keeps it even. It keeps it doesn't kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not like Game of Thrones and books like that, because Game of Thrones really takes its foot off the pedal in quite a few places.
To be fair, I think Game of Thrones' problem is more just its need to go off on like 70 tangents. Different tangents.
Yeah.
But this, it doesn't have that problem that a lot of books have, where it feels like this scene is taking place just to fill up some pages.
Yeah. Do you know what it reminds me of? You remember I talked about Dragon Hunters, the second book in the Chronicles of the Exile.
Yeah, because I think there's a character in that gets captured by some other civilization, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. Probably a lot like that.
It's kind of like that, and it's about, because it just seems similar to Dragon Hunters, only more of a historical fantasy, less of the outright fantasy.
Yeah, yeah, because this is very much written in the style of historical fantasy.
And the reason why I liken it to Dragon Hunters is because When the Heavens Fall, the first book, was a lot like Game of Thrones. There was multiple protagonists, there were multiple characters to focus on, so it kept going off on tangents and stuff like that. But the second book was very much focused on the one character, which this sounds like it is.
Yeah, yeah, this. We have a single protagonist.
Yeah.
My God, I've missed that in a book.
Oh, God, yes. Do you know, I've been reading these light novels, and that is the one thing that I like about the light novels, is that they're mainly focused on a single protagonist, and it's like an oasis in the desert. given the books that we've been reading lately.
Yeah, plus it means you can have a character who has a full and satisfying arc throughout the course of a book.
And then there is the other Isabella Trent.
Yes.
I love her.
You just holding up that book with that goofy smile across your face.
I love Isabella Trent. She's amazing. And the thing is, it's all about her.
Yeah, I look forward to finding out about her one day.
You will do, because I will bring the book in. I finished it. I just forgot to bring it with me.
One day, Rob. Anyway, one last thing about Clash of Eagles.
Yes.
That, like all good books should have, there's an appendix at the back.
Yes.
I think, four appendices.
Okay.
So the first one is basically, he explains how a lot of what he's written about Cahokia, the author that is based on kind of a real civilization.
Yeah.
Like their city is an actual real place in America. But there's obviously had to take quite a few liberties as well.
Yeah.
It's kind of moving things up historically and just completely inventing the glider thing.
Yeah.
And I like that it takes time to, like, kind of lay that out.
Yeah.
Then he's also got kind of a little dictionary of some of the Roman terms that get used. So just, like, what things like centurion and praetor mean, which is a nice touch.
Yeah.
Then the bit I really like is just a little bit on kind of how history has differed. Because I'll just find it again. No, that's... Okay, so the idea is, basically, after the death of Septimus Severus in AD 211, which happened in real life. So in real life, his sons, Caracalla and Geta, they ruled Rome together for a little bit.
Yeah.
Until Caracalla assassinated Geta and took the throne for himself. But in this, it is the two brothers went to war instead. Which ended up with Geta killing his brother and taking the throne.
Yeah.
And through that, Rome was able... Basically, it was quite a bloody civil war that brought Rome to kind of the brink of ruin.
Yeah.
But through that, they were able to rise up kind of even stronger and harder.
Yeah.
And like basically, that's why there's still a Roman Empire in the 1200s.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I like that because I feel like a lot of historical fiction, it'll just say things like, oh, what if the British Empire never fell? But we'll never bother to explain how that came about.
You know, that kind of... I know people don't like his books, but David Gemmell, there's some people who don't like his books, but he did a... It was a pair of books. First one was The Lion of Macedon, which was purely a historical fantasy. And the second one was Dark Prince, which was kind of a story about Alexander the Great and various things like that. But that was more fantasy than historical fantasy. But The Lion of Macedon is an amazing book, and it's exactly what you, like you said. At the back of it, he's got a little bibliography of all of the books that he referenced.
Yeah,
and he referenced
a
lot.
That's what the Fourth Appendices is.
Yeah.
It's a list of like what he's referenced and further reading.
Yeah, because that's exactly what David Gemmell did as well when he wrote Lion of Macedon. And there's all of these books that he's basically looked through and referenced himself in order to write this book about a half-Spartan kid who basically becomes the greatest enemy of Sparta in ancient Greece and ends up working for Philip II of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great.
Nice. But see, I like that idea of, because it's set in the real world, actually thoroughly researching where you're going to set it.
Because the thing is, Lion of Macedon is one of Gemmell's best books, I reckon. It is such a superb read in loads of ways. Part of that is because it's been so well researched.
Exactly. I mean, basically, it avoids the common form of fantasy by having like this already very rich and in-depth world just waiting for you.
Yeah.
You just need to be able to do the legwork to properly study it.
Yeah. Another good historical fantasy that I'd recommend is The Lions of Al-Rassan. Both of mine have lions in for some reason.
You like
animals.
Lions.
Animals seem to feature heavily. Yours is eagles.
Mine is eagles.
And mine's lions for some reason. Eagles and lions, we should get together and raise an empire.
And bears, oh my.
Yes. Yes. Eagles, lions, and bears. The Lions of Al-Rassan is all about Spain during the last days of the Caliphate before the Christians took back Spain or the Spanish Peninsula from the Moors. And it's kind of, it's set in the latter days of that between there's the three faiths, you know, there's the worshippers of the sun, and then there's the worship of the worshippers of Ashar and the stars, and then there's the Kindath who represent the Jews.
Yeah.
And it's all about doctors, or it's all about a doctor, a female doctor in that environment. And she meets two of the most brilliant men of the age, Rodrigo Belmonte and Ammar ibn Karen, the man who killed the last caliph of Al-Rasan.
Ooh, I like that. I think you might have mentioned this before. It sounds familiar.
It has an amazing scene in that book. Just one of the most amazing scenes. And I'll make this really quick so we can go on to the Shakespeare ones. The female doctor, her dad, saved the Sultan's favorite concubine, was having a difficult childbirth, and her dad saved her and the child, right? But because he basically looked at the naked form of the Sultan's concubine, the normal procedure would be he would have to be put to death, but the Sultan was so grateful to this man, he basically made sure that he would never want for anything else in his entire life, and then took out his eyes and cut off his tongue.
Damn.
But he was still probably the greatest doctor of the age, because at the end, one of Rodrigo Belmonte's sons, he takes a massive blow to the head in a raid, and everybody's given up on him until this doctor, blind and speaking in mangled words, performs the first trepanning operation in the world.
That sounds like a really cool book.
And just the whole thing is just given this really magical description, but it's an operation, it's a medical procedure that takes on this whole...
Yeah, but it's written in terms of like how it must seem to them.
Yeah.
Ooh, I like that.
I'll have to bring it in for you because you're going to love The Lions of Al-Rasan. Anyway, right, so I think we leave books and very quickly go through Shakespeare.
Yes. Time to get artsy.
Time to get artsy indeed.
Incredibly highbrow.
Yes, incredibly highbrow. And I'm going to go from 1 to 10 because they gradually get more evocative. Now, these are 10 alternative insults for all of you people, and these are right in my wheelhouse because I'm a big fan of the creative insult, you know, the artistic put down.
Yes.
Starting off with simple things. Scurvy politician. Get thee glass eyes that like a scurvy politician seem to see the things thou dost. Scurvy in Shakespeare means contemptible or despicable, while he used a politician to mean a crooked plotter or schemer. Nothing changed there.
No. I was going to say that, but it seemed like just too low-hanging fruit.
Oh, this is brilliant. Thou damned and luxurious mountain goat.
That's amazing.
Yes. You know, luxurious mountain goat might seem like something you want to pet, but in Shakespeare's day, luxurious meant louche or hedonistic, and the randy behaviour of goats was enough to transform it into an insult.
So Shakespeare called someone a slutty ghost.
Yes. Thou damned doorkeeper to every custrel that comes inquiring for his tib.
Just sounds slightly filthy.
The thing is, there's nothing wrong with the doorkeeper, but it's a doorkeeper to a brothel. Right. Where got'st thou that goose look? After he's called the servant, bringing him news of an army of 10,000 English soldiers on their way north, a cream-faced loon, Macbeth, asks him, where got'st thou that goose look? In other words, why do you look so stupid?
And it's great because the kind of person you could call a goose look would in no way understand it.
Yes. Base dunghill villain and mechanical.
And mechanical.
Yes. Shakespeare used mechanical to mean a menial, unskilled worker. So all in all, base dunghill villain and mechanical is the lowliest of the low. Finch egg.
Finch egg.
Yeah. Thersites calls Patroclus a finch egg in Troilus and Cressida, probably in the sense that it's a fairly small, insignificant thing. This one just... You Banbury cheese!
Banbury cheese!
Yes.
It's amazing! I'm going to call everyone that now.
Banbury in Oxfordshire is well known for its rich, thick milk cheese, so calling someone a Banbury cheese, as Badolph does in The Merry Wives of Windsor, is just another way of pointing out how stupid they are. you bulls pizzle. Well, we know what that is. Yeah. As well as calling him a starveling, an elf skin, a dried neat's tongue, and a stockfish, all metaphors for scrawny, shrunken, next to nothings, Falstaff calls the young Prince Hal a bull's pizzle in Henry IV, Part 1. A pizzle, of course, yeah, is his wang. You scullion, you rampallion, you fustilarian. After Falstaff finished calling Mistress Quickly a scullion, a low-ranking drudge, a rampallion, a scoundrel, and a fustilarian, a Shakespearean invention, probably meaning a fat woman, he shouts, I'll tickle your catastrophe.
Oh my God.
In other words, he's got to smack her on her posterior. I'll tickle your catastrophe. I'm sorry, but I'm
going to get all up in the club and tickle that catastrophe.
Yeah. You whoreson cullionly barbermonger.
Barbermonger.
I'm just going to say that again. You whoreson cullionly barbermonger. Or so Kent calls Oswald in Act 2 of King Lear. As well as calling him a cullionly barbermonger, in other words, a vain rascal who spends an inordinate amount of time primping his appearance, Kent calls Oswald an eater of broken meats, a scavenger, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, 100-pound, filthy, worsted, stocking knave. A vain, scrawny brown noser. Love that Shakespeare is like really long.
That is a translation is tirade.
A lily-livered, action-taking knave, a whoreson, a litigious coward, a glass-gazing, super-serviceable, finical rogue, a vain brown noser, and the son and heir of a mongrel bitch, one whom I will beat into clamorous whining if thou deniest the least syllable of thy addition.
And that is a put-down.
I like Falstaff.
He's got all the best lines.
Yes, he does. So, yeah. Now I know why I liked Peter Dinklage's character so much in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, because he's basically Falstaff.
Yes, he is. So, those are 10 and a little bit more Shakespeare insults that are much better than what you would have used before, you Banbury cheese.
So now, go forth, my children, and tickle that catastrophe.
Yes. Tickle it hard. Right, okay, so we're at the end of the show, so we're going to leave you for another week. Remember, work on your insults. It's fun to come up with creative insults.
Yes, yes it is.
I have been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all next week.
Thanks for listening.